Okay, welcome back, everybody. For those of you who are in the front of the room, thank you. So, what we have here is we have first Jude. Jude, where did you go? I lost Jude.
He's in the front, by the
way. Okay. How many judges do we have in the group tonight? How many group judges do we have?
You have three teams.
You know, one, two. You're the third?
No, there are three teams.
I know there are three. I'm looking for who's the third. Oh, we got three teams of judges here. All right, so our first judge group that we have is the PCA, which stands for Piedmont Council for the Arts. Piedmont Council for the Arts. Their mission is to sustain the thriving presence of arts in Charlottesville. Provide support services to artists, art organizations, and audiences. So, you have events that go on with your place as well, correct? Yes. So, the next one that you have is June 12th from 5:30 to 7:30. It's like an arts schmooze type of thing, where you get together and art drinks. Art schmoozing. Schmoozing with artists. That is at Positively 4th Street. And then there's an artist workshop, Courting the Media, Strategies for Getting Your Coverage. And that's May 23rd from 12 o'clock to 1:30 at City Space. If you need more information on that, talk to Jessica. Our second group of judges is, what is the name of the group?
The Escutcheons.
The Escutcheons. They dress up the hole. That's what the escutcheon is. The escutcheons. And our third judging group? The random guessers. All right. So we've got DCA, the escutcheons, and the random guessers. So what will happen is these group of judges, they've been meticulously hand-selected by asking them when they came through the door, would you take this piece of paper and be a judge? And they said yes. So for one of the next jams, you too could be a judge. And what you do is you're judging on the detail, the amount of motion that is raised, the humor, the whether it fell, the story fell within the time limits. What else is on your list of you?
Time, the journey, the flow.
And then these guys, the random, they're just random. So, you could be a judge for one of the next storytelling groups. The next storytelling jam is June 20th. The theme is nature. You got that? The next slam that we're having is July 18th. What's a slam? So the next storytelling slam is all of the winners from previous months. These are the people who were chosen by our meticulously selected judges to be a winner for that month's theme. So July 18th, all those winners will come back head to head and they will tell their story. Different story, not their story, a different story. We also have Big Blue Door classes and class shows. Upcoming May 21st is the Improv Showcase. May 29th is the Telling True Stories Show. It's the class show. You can find it. You're not listening to me, I can tell. You're talking amongst yourselves, I caught you. So you can find all of these details at bigbluedoor.org. Okay, Big Blue Door also has a Facebook page. You go on the Facebook, Big Blue Door, it comes really quick and easy. It's not one of those things you have to scroll through all the tedious other Big Blue Door organizations. This is the one. It's it, man. It's right there. So, and if this looks like fun, if you're sitting at home and you're thinking about this skydiving, skinny dipping thing, and you want to tell a story next month, contact us at bigbluedoor.org and say, you know what, man? I got a story. I think this is going to work. Because we are always looking for new people to tell stories. Contact info, bigbluedoor.org. It's right there. Also find out classes at bigbluedoor.org or shows at bigbluedoor.org. Okay, moving on. Our next performer is Elizabeth Derby. Elizabeth Derby is a nonfiction writer. She's also a member of Writer House. She's also a marketing consultant, and gosh, she's an all-around great gal.
We get to write our own bios, obviously. This is a true story that I've never told before. And I like words, so it's a big deal. I was born a month early, and I was perfect. Perfect height, perfect weight, perfect cultish limbs that caused both the doctor and my father to say, "Nice legs." Baby fat was soon to follow, but my physical health was superb. I sailed past all the problems that my peers had. Never had braces, perfect spinal alignment, and my projected height rivaled my classroom standing, 99th percentile. My precocious ability to craft expository essays won me a spot at a local performing arts high school. I transferred when I was 15, and while perfect Elizabeth wowed the teachers, I noticed my peers were interested in the off-kilter stuff. So I embraced my latent subversive side, the part of me that liked hair dye and vicious sarcasm. And my sudden abundance of friends took to calling me Derbs, a moniker that I welcomed as a foil to the perfect girl that I'd been. If a rivalry is a conflict between two opposing forces, then this is when mine started, in high school, with two personalities fighting for stage time, each trying to please totally different audiences. In social situations, typically, Derbs came out on top. She was funny and laid back, and she didn't judge her stoner friends or the straight guys who took her to gay clubs on teen night. She was ready to party, and I don't mean like cocaine, I just mean like a drink here and there. It was badass within reason. But when I went home, perfect Elizabeth was the rule of the roost. I basically did whatever my mom wanted me to do. I knew that that was the way forward. When my mom ranted about pot and the people who smoke it, I nodded very solemnly and was like, "I will never do that." And Derbs didn't really give a shit. You know, she was a live and let live type of girl, but perfect Elizabeth knew better than to rock the boat. When I went away to college in Virginia, Derbs took on a life of her own. I slipped her on with mini skirts and with every shot of Bacardi Razz. She came out of frat parties and made out with strange men. And during the tall tales that we told around Sunday brunches, perfect Elizabeth took a beating. But she reasserted herself when I went home for breaks, and she said anything my mom wanted to hear. And my life became this series of half-truths, jumping back and forth between warring sides. And beneath the sparring, there was a small voice that said, "You're not really happy." I knew that I wanted, secretly, something constant and a love that was pure. I don't really see that happening, so I just laughed it off with my friends, like, who gets lonely in college? And would write my angst, my bad behavior, the things I was starting to hate about myself in my journal, and then I tried to forget about them. So my senior year of college, I went home for Christmas break, and my mother and sister and I went to go see the movie The Holiday, which is, among other things, it's a romantic comedy, and Cameron Diaz like falls into bed with Jude Law after like 3 minutes, because who wouldn't? And we left the theater, and I'm in this post-rom-com bliss, and then my mom starts tearing the movie apart. She says, "Cameron Diaz is such a slut, and I can't believe that Jude Law would respect her, and Jesus, she took her clothes off before they even shook hands." I was sitting in the car, and Derbs starts to get a little offended. She says, "You know what? I don't think she was a slut. You know what? I think it's a generational thing. And I sat there silently fuming, and my mom asked me what the problem was. I said, nothing. I just need to sleep. So the next day, I went to the shopping mall, because it was Christmas in New Jersey. That's what you do. And I was wrapping up my errands, and I got a phone call from my mother saying, I need you to come home. We need to talk. Everyone knows that feeling when your mom tells you you need to talk. My stomach sank, and I rushed home, and I tried to arrange Elizabeth perfectly. And I walked into the kitchen. My mom was sitting there with the gray winter sky pressed up against the windows behind her. She had my journal open in front of her. My mouth went dry. She said, I'm sorry I read this, but I needed to know why you got so mad last night. And a couple things happened. So in my mind, Durbs flipped out and was like, how dare you? That's my journal. It's a violation of my privacy. And Elizabeth's like, oh my God, this is the end. She's going to know about the boys and the booze. And that one time you tried pot, it's over. And 10 years of conflict were just frothing in my stomach. And then this little voice popped up and said, you want to have this conversation. It wasn't really a conversation, actually. I sat down at the table and my mom talked to me. She said, you know, Elizabeth, these things that you've been doing, they're really self-destructive. They show that you don't care about your body, you don't care about your heart. And I wouldn't let anybody treat my daughter like this, not even you. That, and I felt perfect Elizabeth just like rip away like this ill-fitting band-aid, and all of Durbs's bravado collapsed. And I sat there defenseless, and she looked at me, she stood, pushed the journal toward me and said, I will always love you, but you have got to start loving yourself. She walked out of the room, and I sat there in silence. My heart was pounding, and I felt sore, my eyes were swollen, my throat hurt, and it was just my heartbeat, and me. Durbs was gone, Elizabeth was gone, and in the quiet, I heard that little voice again, and she said, maybe one day, the truth won't be so scary. Maybe one day, you'll be able to tell this story, and you'll be able to say it out loud.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Next up, we have Emily Bolichek. Emily works for Relay Foods. She's also an associate producer for Big Blue Door and enjoys taking improv classes and dressing up for costume parties. Emily?
Hello. There was a girl I went to high school with named Leanne. Leanne was very bossy and very uptight. She used to put her spiral notebooks into Ziploc bags and kept them in her book bag so that they wouldn't get wrinkled. Leanne and I spent every waking minute of high school together, and this is because we were in all of the same activities. We were on the cheerleading team together, we were in every honors class, every AP class together, we were in all the clubs together, and we had all of the same friends. So it's kind of unavoidable. But it was unfortunate because Leanne did not like me. In fact, she was a bully. There were occasional moments when I thought, oh, like this will be a redeeming friendship. Like she did something nice, we'll be friends. But then she was mean again. So we kind of teetered on this like edge of being friends and being enemies. To kind of give you an example of what she was like, one day we were leaving cheerleading practice and I was driving in my car behind Leanne and I accidentally rear-ended her. So I like freak out, I'm 16, it's my first car accident, I run out of the car, I like bang on her car door window, she rolls it down, And I'm just like relieved that she's alive, even though it's a very small ending. And so I like reach into the car to hug her, and she puts her hand in my face and she goes, "Emily, please, I'm on the phone with the police." And that's who she was. Like, her first instinct was to call the cops and to make sure that I got a ticket for rear ending her. So throughout high school, when she was just really mean to me or bullying me, I would just dream about college and how awesome college was going to be, especially because we were going to different colleges. Since freshman year, Leanne had like dreamed about going to William and Mary, and that's all she talked about. And during senior year, I applied to UVA early admission, and I got accepted, so I knew in December of senior year that I would be going to UVA. So I thought, 4 years apart, I'll never see her again, it'll be awesome. So one day during the spring of senior year, Leanne gets her acceptance letter to William & Mary, and she also gets her acceptance letter to UVA, her backup school. And she marches into English class one day, and she's like, "I've changed my mind, I'm going to UVA." And I was devastated. This was the worst news of my life. And I was also pretty angry because I felt like there was this unspoken agreement that we had that we would go to different colleges. And I feel like she totally betrayed that. And so I was mad. So a couple weeks later, it's right before graduation, and we were sitting in English class together. And Leanne says, "Hey, Emily, I'm going to be late today to the senior awards assembly," which we had after school. And she was like, "So could you save me a seat at the end of the row?" And I was like, "Ugh, I don't want to save her a seat. I want to sit next to her." So I decided I would tell my friend Meredith to save her a seat to kind of get out of this duty. So I was like, "Hey, Meredith, Leanne's going to be late to the awards assembly after school today, and she wants us to save her a seat at the end of the row. Probably because she thinks she's going to win all of the awards and have to get up a lot. Like, why else would she need a seat at the end of the row?" And Meredith, my friend who was kind of half listening to this story, says, "Wait, what? She said she was going to win all of the awards?" And I was like, "Yes. She did say that." And Meredith was like, "She is so conceited. Oh my God." And I was like, I got this like rush of adrenaline, and I was like, holy shit. So I decided that I would like test this out on a few more people. So I like started telling a few other friends, and they were like, "Nuh-uh, she did not say she was going to win all of the awards." And I was like, "Well, I mean, she did specifically ask for a seat at the end of the row." And so between fifth period and the end of the day, I had kind of unintentionally spread this rumor about Leanne that had spread through the entire senior class. And so after school, we get to the gym, and they set up this like dinky little stage, and then there's like rows of plastic chairs. And at the end of each row were empty chairs lining the auditorium or the gym. And everyone had heard about this rumor and like saved seats on the end of the row just to spite Leanne. And so Leanne gets to this awards assembly late. She like doesn't really realize. She sits down, and then she proceeds to win like 95% of the senior awards. She was really smart. And you could just like feel this energy in the room. Like, people were like boiling with anger. And they were just like, every time like Leanne was called, it was just like, oh. So Leanne found out that I had spread this rumor about her. And so after the awards assembly, she like runs up to find me, and she goes, "Emily, parking lot now." And so I follow her out to the parking lot, I'm like shaking. And like everyone from the senior class like is like peeking around their cars, like watching this go down. And we had this like emotional brawl in the parking lot. And Leanne was like, "Basically, you're a crummy person. I'm a better person than you. And for your punishment, you will call every single person you told this rumor to and tell them it was not true." And so I don't do well with getting in trouble, and I just felt really remorseful, and I couldn't believe I was so mean, so I was just crying and crying, and I go home that night, and I call, like, half of the senior class, literally, on my, like, telephone, And I'm like, I'm really sorry, I did say this about Liam, it ended up being true. So it was kind of a rumorous spread, but it was kind of true. But she didn't actually say that, although she implied it by saying she was going to sit at the end of the row. Come on. And so this was like my half-hearted apology that I told everyone in the senior class. Needless to say, Leanne and I did not hang out that summer after graduation. And the next time I saw Leanne was on the first night of college. I was with like every girl in my dorm that I had just met, like all my cool new friends, and we got dressed up and we were going to go to a frat party. And so we're like walking to this frat party and I see Leanne and she's walking towards me, like back towards dorms. And she's all by herself, and she looks like really deflated and like alone. And so I kind of like sucked up my pride, and I was like, Leanne, why don't you come with us? And Leanne said, Emily, there's underage drinking at frat parties. And I was like mortified, because I'm in front of like all my cool new friends, right? And so I was like, Leanne, shh, I know, but like you could still come and like hang out and have fun and not drink. And she's like, oh, well, I guess I never really considered that. And so she came with me to the frat party. And that night, Leanne and I went to our first frat party together, and we embarked on what was a very odd, yet somewhat redeeming friendship. Thank you.
Thanks, Emily. And our last is Casey Soskamp. Casey is a research scientist at UVA, hosts the storytelling game show podcast, Flee the Scene. You can find it at fleethescenepod.com. Casey?
Hello, all right. I'm 24. It's my second year as a grad student at NYU. And I've just moved to Brooklyn. And that means I can finally have people stay over my apartment. I have a couch in the hallway that is the living room of my tiny railroad apartment, and I can make a pretty decent pile of sheets and towels in my bedroom, but I can have people stay over. I have a pretty tight-knit group of friends back home in Pittsburgh, and this weekend, three of them are coming to visit me. Shane is taking a bus in from Pittsburgh. Amanda and Jason, who are dating, take a train in from Boston. Shane is a party guy. He goes to raves, he's a DJ. Amanda is a neurotic ball of stress, but she also likes hippie jam bands and weird art stuff. Jason is laid back, defers to the group. He is a perfect boyfriend for Amanda. And I'm a pleaser. I don't want anybody to not be happy, even if that means I'm having a terrible time. They arrive, and that Saturday, we spend the morning and afternoon doing tourist stuff. We go to Times Square, Chinatown, Central Park. That night, I realize that we have some competing plans for what's going to go on. Amanda wants to go to this music and art show in the East Village. There's a guitar player and a cellist who play along to these weird found footage videos. Shane wants to go to a psychedelic dance party in Midtown. After 30 minutes of their bickering, I convince them we can do both. The music and art show doesn't start until 8, and I assure Shane that nobody is going to be at this rave until 11 o'clock at the earliest. And if we are going to be late, I will get us a cab. We settle down, we take the subway into the village, and we drop acid along the way. The music and art show is not Shane's scene at all. It's full of hipsters, beer costs $7, and there's nowhere to sit. The only redeeming factor is that the videos that they're playing along to are really legitimately hilarious, even sober. I've watched them since, they're really funny. There are penguins falling down, and evangelists flopping around on the floor, and karate guys doing flips. But the thing is, when you're on acid, you can't control your laughter.
So every time a chuckle just starts to escape Shane's lips, these serious hoopsters are just rolling their eyes and shushing him the minute anything happens. So for the next 2 hours, Shane is begging us to leave. Amanda and Jason are having a great time. Finally, before the second encore, Shane leaves. Amanda protests. Jason just kind of shrugs his shoulders. I apologize. We follow Shane out. We hail a cab. And we take some more acid. The psychedelic dance party is at a warehouse in Midtown, and there are a lot of other parties going on. Most of them are these club and hip-hop parties for the Bridget and Tunnel crowd, and so there's girls with too much makeup and sparkly short dresses and two tanned bros with popped collars and gelled hair. I don't know exactly where we're supposed to go in this big, huge building, so I follow a dude with dreadlocks and a girl who has a glow-in-the-dark Hello Kitty backpack. We follow them through these hallways and back rooms, and Amanda is freaked out because she thinks we are not supposed to be there and we're going to the wrong place. We eventually make it to the rave room, and there are only four people there, because it's 11 o'clock, and it's New York City. And this freaks out Amanda even more. She's totally convinced we're not supposed to be there. But pretty soon, we start to hear, and so we know that we're in the right place, and the music starts, and Amanda settles in. We dance like idiots for the next 2 hours of a total blur. Then Amanda comes running up to me, panicked. There are drunk girls from the club parties in the bathroom, and they are throwing up, and one of them is doing coke. Reminding Amanda that we have done two hits of acid does nothing to make her feel any better. Half an hour of dancing later, I get a text that Amanda and Jason are down the street at an H&H Bagels. I relay this to Shane, and he's been having such a great time. I don't want to make him leave now, so I say, we'll leave in a little bit. 10 minutes later, I look over to Shane. He's the kind of guy who has a lot of dandruff, and he is wearing a black t-shirt, and he's standing under black light. And so even though I know I'm on acid, this isn't happening, when I'm looking at him in all of this dandruff, I see him melting away into a skeleton. Now it's time to go. We meet Jason and Amanda at the bagel shop at 2 a.m. Amanda wants to go back to Brooklyn. Shane wants to find a bar in Manhattan. We decide to go back to Brooklyn. Amanda wants to take a cab. Shane wants to save money and take the subway. We agree to take the subway. What I didn't know is that Penn Station, after midnight, turns into a nightmare hellscape. As soon as we pay our $2 fare and enter, there is a hand-scrawled note saying the F train is down. So we head over to the one train, but there's a sign saying that it's running on the express track. We get over and we wait on the express track, and then we see the one train going down the local line. So we bolt on over to the local line, but now there's a gate that's covering the gate to get to the local track. So I find a new way, but this way is full of homeless people. And we are running down the hallway, and they start to lurch out at us, and they're grabbing at us and yelling at us. It's like Dawn of the Dead. Help us! Help us! And we run, and we make it down the hallway just in time to see the train come on a completely different track! We give up. We're not going to get a train. So we follow signs to an exit. And we get to the exit, but there is a gate covering it. There is a homeless man in front of the gate, and he has a bullhorn. And he is yelling at us, get out of here! Get out of here! Get out of here! And we backtrack as fast as we can. And the bullhorn has agitated the rest of the homeless people, so they are taunting us and yelling at us and screaming at us and following us. And we went through hallway to hallway, finding nothing but dead ends and closed gates and more homeless people. And then finally, we hear the sound of street noise. And we follow the sound, and we make it out of Penn Station. Jason comforts Amanda. Shane is still upset that we left the rave. I tell everyone, look at it this way. We paid $2 for a really good haunted house. The cab ride back to Brooklyn was completely silent. Amanda and Shane are staring daggers at each other in the back seat. We get back to my living room where we all mope around. Amanda and Shane continue to argue about who ruined the night. Amanda eventually falls asleep crying on the couch. Shane spends an hour throwing a tennis ball against my sleeping roommate's door before he passes out in the pile of towels and sheets in my bedroom. I get my headphones, I go onto my back porch, and I put on some dance music, and I have my own rave on my back porch. Thanks.
Meticulously selected group of judges are tabulating your votes right now. We would like to take this time to thank Jody Plaisance, who has done the door. Thank you, Jody. Our sound engineer, Seth, do a great job on sound. Thank you, Seth. Our timekeeper, Molly. Molly with a shaker. Thank you, Molly. Our producer, Jude. Thank you, Pete. Recordings of all Big Blue Door jams will hopefully someday be available online. We're not sure how long it's going to work. We think that maybe if you would donate some money, it might help the project get solved. I think we need better recording equipment. Is that what it is? If there was better recording equipment, then
better recording equipment and somebody who can help edit.
Someone who can do the editing. That's the key thing, is an editor is needed. Yeah. You can still throw money at the problem, but we need an editor.
Thank you.
So, I wasn't in the United States when 9/11 happened. I was living in Switzerland. I was working as an English teacher. I had just quit my job as a courier in New York, and I always thought that the towers were like a visual blight. I think they were ugly. I really didn't like them. Every time I would drive approaching the city, I'd be like, oh God, there they are. They're just sort of like standing there. It's like, geez, I mean, there's so many good looking buildings and these two ugly things in there. I used to hate those towers all the time. So here I am in Switzerland on the other side of the world. And that's when somebody tells me, hey, somebody's flying some planes into the towers in New York. I couldn't believe it. So my wife and I, we went back to, we were living with her parents then, so in the foothills of the Alps. It was so bizarre. We're in like this little Swiss chalet in the foothills of the Alps watching CNN to see what's going on. It was so strange, and I felt this wave of guilt. I felt so guilty because I thought those towers were so ugly. And I'm just watching it, just astounded at what's going on. And my father-in-law, who's never left Switzerland, he said he climbed the mountain once when he was in the military and saw France. But other than that, he's never left Switzerland. He's just watching, and he can't believe, like, you Americans, I mean, what do you do? So he's looking at me with these, like, eyes of contempt. We had just met because we had just moved into their house. And he's looking at me, and he asks me in Swiss German, how tall are those buildings? And I said, in high German, because I didn't speak dialect, I said, 110 stories. And he looked at his daughter, my wife, and he said, what did he say? 110 stories, she said. And then he'd watch it a little bit, and this just look on his face. He was just like, why would people do this to each other? You know, because that's not how life is in the foothills of the Alps. And he looked at me and he said, how many people work in those buildings? And I answered in German, well, probably about, I don't know, 60, 70,000 people. He said, in the buildings? I said, yeah, in the buildings. And he looked at my wife and said, how many people did he say once in the buildings? And she said, I don't know, 60, 70,000. He just shakes his head. And there was always this tension between him and I, but I noticed it most when he was looking at me, not as his son-in-law that he didn't really like, but as an American. And I noticed it in my classes. I'm teaching, and this one guy, he says, well, that's really a shame what's happened to the people in the United States and the people in New York. And this other guy says, these Americans, I mean, they do these things all the time. They give money to people with guns. They give money to other countries to shoot other people. And they're constantly helping everybody die. And somebody flies some airplanes into the buildings and poor little America starts crying. And he looked at me and he was like, you people are very strange. I was like, wow, I mean, the emotions with what he said, it just felt terrible. I felt really guilty just to be from the United States. So I decided, when you move to a foreign country, it's sort of like dressing up in a costume. You can put on any persona you want. So I got a job as a ditch digger, and when people ask, where are you from? I had grown this big mustache, I would say, Serbia. And I frowned a lot because I figured Serbian people frown a lot. And they would say, you're Serbian? And I would say, dobro jutro, kako se? And they said, yeah, he's Serbian. So, and that's basically the whole thing, is I would learn these Serbian phrases from the painters and the drywallers or something like that, and I just would pretend that I was Serbian all the time. And then I needed a motorcycle, and this was my next chance to play a role or something. I bought this old Russian motorcycle with a sidecar, a Dnieper, and it had like these big handlebars, and it was built on a 1940, it looked like a 1948 BMW. It had a machine gun mount on the sidecar. Mine didn't have a machine gun, but had them out there. And so I would drive this thing around, and I would wear this leather double-breasted jacket with chrome buttons and this half helmet with goggles. And I mean, I looked like a Nazi. And I'm driving around, and I kind of figured, this is my chance to make things right. And I decided I'm going to be the friendliest Nazi. And so I'm driving the motorcycle around, and people would look at me as I'm driving around, and I'd like wave at them. It was like it was a big parade. I'm driving around. And it was so fun, just sort of driving around, and I would honk the horn sometimes and wave at children and wave at old men who were like, I had a motorcycle like that in the war. It was so fun. So I'm driving home from my ditch digging job one day, and over in a park, I see these two people. I see this blonde-haired, blue-eyed Swiss guy, and I see him picking up clumps of dirt and throwing it at a guy that was Muslim. And I'm driving off, and I go, wait a minute, what did I just see? And I turned around, and that's when I can see the guy is like screaming, the Swiss guy is screaming in German at this Muslim guy and throwing clods of dirt. And the Muslim guy is just standing there. He's not doing anything. He's just standing there. And dirt's like hitting him in the face and the chest and stuff. I'm thinking, this is outrageous. I got to do something. So I turn around, and I'm driving back, and I go up over the curb, and I'm on my Nazi Harley, my Nazi motorcycle, and I'm driving through the grass, and I'm coming up to him, and I start revving it, and I get up to the Swiss guy, and I hit him with a sidecar, knock him down. I'm like, ah! And he stands up, and he's looking at me like, what you do that for? And I started yelling at him, screaming in German, trying to tell him, get out of here, you don't treat people like that. And he's like, and he gets up, and he goes to grab another clod of grass, and I hit him again, and he takes off running. And the guy, he's standing there, and he's just completely amazed, like, what just happened? And so I turn the bike off, and he says, who are you? And he asked me in English. And I said, are you okay? And he said, yeah, I'm fine. Who are you? Why did you do that? And I said, I mean, that guy was harassing you. He's like, I was fine. Who are you? And I took off my helmet, and I mean, instead of the first thing that came to my mind, I said, I'm an American. And I thought, I don't know if that would make things better or explain something. I don't know. It was just the first thing I blurted out. And he was like, what's with you people? I was spat on my shoe. And he turned around and walked away. So, judges, do we have it? We're good. Have something to drink, and make sure to tip your waitstaff. Thank you.